that better? Can you guys hear me okay in the back? Sorry about that. This network that's being built, and I want to emphasize that it's being built because it's only about 15 months old, has grown to over 6,000 members and over 300 volunteers in that short of a time. And the reason it's being built and the reason it's growing like that, 8% a month right now is our growth rate. The reason that's happening is because people see that there's a need out there for this kind of connectivity that we can establish, that there's a growing demand for risk management in places like Eastern Europe, Asia, South America, and even in Africa, places where you might be surprised that there are risk managers. We have 4 in Kenya, not a place I expected to have risk managers be joining our association. And we even had our first risk manager join from Cuba. Now, if that's not an indication that the profession of risk management is expanding to places that we wouldn't expect, I don't know of a better one. I have hesitated to contact that person directly for fear that something might happen to them because they joined just about the time a number of academicians were sent to prison. So we'll hope that's just sort of an anonymous registration that occurs. Premia is a network of local chapters. Dan's our head here in Toronto. Alexander Shipoloff, who is sitting over there, who you might be surprised, is our regional director from Spain, previously a regional director in Russia, and now living in Toronto. Michelle Cruy, who's here, is on our Blue Ribbon panel of advisors. And if I'm missing anyone else in the audience, Dan?
Ron was here.
Oh, Ron was, yeah, Ron left. Ron's also on our Blue Ribbon panel. Again, what you'll wind up finding out is the places you go, cities where we have chapters, there is a fairly extensive list of people who are involved as volunteers. We are a nonprofit association. We operate on a very limited budget. We don't have member dues, so it's a free association to join. And our funding comes through 3 different sources: sponsorship, firms like Algo, who's contributed sponsorship to us, through a professional risk manager program, which I'll talk a little bit about in a second, and through some conferences that we have. One that's coming up in Boston on June 9th, featuring Glenn Hubbard, who is the recent chair of the Council of Economic Advisors for the Bush administration, featuring Richard Sandor, father of the financial futures markets, and Elliot Spitzer, who has helped us define the value of operational risk, at least in the financial services industry, and may have more work to do. I think it's an exciting place to come. Michelle will be there. A number of people who are here will be there as well speaking. It is a fundraiser for Premia, so it's one of the ways that we fund the organization, and it really is, I believe, the best day on risk that's out there right now, the best assembly of speakers on risk. So what are we doing with Premia? 37 chapters around the world right now. That should grow to about 50 with expansion in Asia and in the United States. We have chapters in terms of Canada in Calgary, Montreal, Toronto, and I would expect some expansion in Canada as well. We'll have between 10 and 12,000 attendees at our chapter meetings this year, and we also offer something called the Professional Risk Manager Program, which is both a certification program for risk managers as well as professional development and assessment. All this stuff's at our website. You can learn more about it there, and I'm very happy afterwards to answer questions for you about Premia. Yes? You know, I'll be careful about that in part because Premia was born for people who were with the association known as GARP. We had all been there. Dan Rosen was one of the people who'd been with GARP for a long time. We left for some reasons that were fairly well covered in the press, and rather than to dig up old issues that were out there, I will say that this group took the energy that was in place when we were all at GARP, transferred it to a new place, and is actually doing things quite a bit differently than what we were doing there in terms of this connection. One of the things I would say that is different about how Premia is operating than what we knew back when we were there is the connectivity that's happening between regional directors. The position I'm in as chair, I was a regional director for Chicago and am still a regional director for Minneapolis in Minnesota. I'm in this position because I got elected to the board and the regional directors chose the officers of the board. We have gotten to know each other very well through this process, and as a result, this network is growing much stronger. So I think you'll see a little bit different focus between the two organizations, but clearly some overlap because that's where we came from. Any other quick questions on Premia? Okay, I would encourage you to stop by the website. Membership is free. We are, maybe if you join and you're a 6,000th member, I'll send you a special email thanking you for joining. Okay, do you want to catch those lights real? Tom's talk that we just heard is one that's fascinated me. It's the second time, at least, I've heard the presentation given. It's been enlightening both times I've listened to it, in part because the progression that I've made in my career as a risk manager came originally from more of a research, more of a quantitative approach, back in the time when options were just starting to hit the market, so the early days of the derivative markets. My career has progressed then more into management levels and into the point where I was starting to discover how I needed to do things as a risk manager in order to get buy-in. Tom went through a great development of some ideas on how things like risk capital and hurdles and hurdle rates impact the business performance. One of the things he mentioned early in his slides was an excuse used often for not using differentiated rates is management buy-in. Guilty. Absolutely guilty. What we tried to do in our firm, the firm that I was working at before doing stuff with Premia full-time, was to make adjustments to the amount of capital that was allocated. And as Tom points out in his paper, that also was not the correct approach. So I appreciate learning from that. But I will say that the management buy-in component is as big of a hurdle as in getting the math correct. And that's a little bit of what I'm going to focus on here. The title, Multiple Points of Failure, might sound like a negative approach to risk management because it says failure. That's not what we're interested in. Even though we'll talk about it a lot, we're not really interested in failure. The concept that I'm going to try to develop here in terms of multiple points of failure is how to turn risk management into a very positive science, into a very positive aspect of the business decision-making role that risk managers are increasingly finding themselves involved in. So let's start out by talking about what we mean by the opposite of multiple points of failure, which would be single points of failure. These, by definition, are systems that are brittle. They break badly. Some examples of systems that break badly I have listed up here. Airport security. Airport security we might think of as something that actually is fairly robust. Go through a line today. How many times have you checked? How many times have you screened? The randomness of having your bags inspected as you go through the gate. Even your shoes set off alarms sometimes now. But it is a single point of failure. If you get through the gate, if you get through the security area and you have the intent to do harmful things, you have free rein. You're in. That's it. The consequences of failure in that system are extraordinary. Passwords. I won't ask you what your passwords are, but how many of you have a different password for every time a password is required? How many of you use the same password over and over again? Everybody should be raising their hands on that, because I think I have two. I'm supposedly chair of a risk management association, and I have two passwords that I use, one that's harder to guess. If a password is discovered, the system fails, and they have free rein. It's a single point of failure. Hard drives. Everybody had a hard drive crash at some point in their life. It's a single point of failure. You think about a hard drive, it is a risk management system. It's something storing your data because you can't possibly keep all of that in paper as well as in your head. The inspiration for this thinking about multiple points of failure actually came from an article in Atlantic Monthly Magazine written by a gentleman who spent his career talking about encryption and super encryption. He was convinced that technology could solve the problems of computer security. So he focused on trying to create even greater and greater complexity to the encryption models, the super encryption notion, so that it didn't matter how good your systems were, how good your computers were, how many of them you strung together, you couldn't possibly have the computing power to break a code. Until he realized this problem back here with passwords. Every system, regardless of the encryption, requires a password to get back to the encryption key that's being used. It's a human being that creates the password, and a human being creates the single point of failure that can violate all of the work that they have done to create super encryption. He's completely changed his thinking on super encryption. He doesn't spend his time focusing on it now. He spends his time focusing on multiple points of failure within systems. These are computer systems, but I thought that the article, and I think it's in the November Atlantic Monthly, I thought the article was so interesting in terms of taking that and translating it into risk management and what we think of it, that I've been thinking more about how to incorporate it in presentations. I think the last name is Scarfo on this. The example he uses in this case was a mafia don, and I think it was in New York, who used super encryption because that was one of the things that the feds had feared. Super encryption would be a tool for criminals. That's what they did. They started to use super encryption. So the mob was exchanging emails. Couldn't break the code, right? So Mr. Scarfo leaves his office one day. Some FBI agents come in. They put a keyboard tracker in on his keyboard. Guess how long it took him to discover his password? Not too long. Right after that, the FBI was building a huge database on everything that was going on within this organization, and the gentleman's in prison. Single point of failure. Thought he had something very complex in place. It failed, and there were consequences that were probably more severe than he had expected. Now, I'm a child of the 80s. I was shaped by the Chicago markets. So I tend to take much more of an approach, an option theoretic approach to, or contingent claim, I guess I should be referring to it these days, approach to valuations. And I think risk management itself is really built on that premise. I am somewhat embarrassed by the awe of the 1987 stock market crash for two reasons. One, I was short equities on the Friday before, and I made a lot of money, so I took the weekend off and closed out all my positions. And the fact that back then, we really were in awe of that stock market crash. The gloom on the street, when you called people on that Monday when things were happening, was incredible. People didn't know what was going on. But embarrassed by it, in part because the things that have happened since then really make that look quite tiny. If you're a child of the 90s, you were probably shaped by the risk management debacles. Orange County, we'll go through a few of those down the road. 94, we had things happen with a bear market in interest rates, and we saw a lot of things in terms of corporate governance issues. And the risk manager in the 1990s moved from someone who was really managing things like portfolios, and doing immunization strategies, to someone who was acting like a cop. Don't do that. You're doing this. That's wrong. Here's the policy. Don't do that. A cop is not a sustainable relationship. You can't be in that role because it becomes combative. You're not going to be invited into a process. But that's what we were. I was a cop in 90... When was I asked most to be a cop? Probably 96, 97. At a mortgage company. And there were some things that we really uncovered that were pretty amazing that people were doing. Every risk manager is still going to have some component of their job that's cop. That doesn't go away. But it can't be the main thing that you're focused on. And if you're a child of the 90s, it might be something that is influencing you. A child of the late 90s was also influenced by risk management debacles. There is some clustering to some extent. There's actually probably more publicity about them than there was before. A child of the late 90s is learning about the interconnectedness of markets. I talked about why premium exists and why it is that it seems to be growing so quickly. Part of that is the interconnectedness. And we are seeing serious advances in quantitative modeling. Your focus in your school here is beyond anything we would have been talking about. When I was a risk manager originally starting, we thought mortgages had 12-year durations, and we actually told people to hedge them that way. Callable mortgages, anybody who followed that strategy probably stopped in about 93. 94, or the market stopped them. But the methods now are really pretty amazing in terms of the amount of intellectual power being put into them. Where we are today in risk management, I'll argue, is in transition. And I think there are two routes that we can go. One is to take the quantitative approach in risk management, because as I mentioned, the cop role isn't sustainable. But to take the quantitative approach and make that what we are. A group that delivers some highly advanced reporting, some statistical guidance to things that are occurring within a business, and leave that to the decision makers to do something with. If we do, I think we're condemned to be, pardon us if there are any accountants in the room, but I do think we're condemned to be like the accounting profession. Accountants generally are not brought into the decision-making process. The CFO might be, but the CFO isn't always thought of as somebody who's really part of the overall strategy. The CFO might be there to tell you about the numbers, how they worked, two or three scenarios I'm going to run through as CFO, and then you make your decision about what you want to do. Those people now in risk management, in this transition phase, who I think are going to take risk management to the next level, are those who see risk management as being something of many nuances. We hear people call it an art. That's a bit, I think, dismissive of the value of the quantitative approach that we bring. But there is some art to this. In part, it's a people science. In part, it's a management science. In part, it's something that, as Tom's paper focused on, we can use to help make the business decisions better. And we realize that nothing is independent. So if you're a risk manager, where are you focused? We talk about distributions. normal distributions, log normal, Poisson, whatever it is that you're looking at. Talk about distributions of events. Risk management tends to focus in two places of that distribution. One is in the middle. That's active risk management. That's indexing, that's immunization strategies, that's the day-to-day delta hedging that you might do of an option position. And another part focuses on the tail of the distribution, valuation of exotics, things that have gammas that approach infinity. Capital allocation is in the tail of the distribution. It's the 1 in 10,000 event. It's the 1 in 5,000 event. That's a tail. And RAROC, which is, again, focused on the tail, because capital is supposed to be there to keep you in business, up to whatever the credit rating is that you're targeting. But what about the path between the middle and the tail? Something happens there. We don't go to the tail immediately. Something's there in the middle. And risk management, in terms of its implications for the business decision-making process, really needs to be looking at the middle as well. And I think it's a bit underserved just now. But I hope to change that. By the way, one thing I should say at the end of this presentation, you'll probably have two comments. One, or I hope you have two comments. One, he didn't say anything new that I hadn't heard already, and that's probably an odd thing to wish for. But the other one is probably to look at this and say, it's a new way of thinking about this. So while we're getting to this point of moving risk from the middle to the tail, I don't think you're going to hear a whole lot of new thoughts from me in terms of advice, but I want to change your mindset in terms of how you approach your job as a risk manager or whatever it is that you start doing. My wife's a pastor, so I sometimes ask this question about whether risk is biblical, because one person said to me sometime that we're in the same profession, that she's a risk manager too. Now, she's a Lutheran pastor, and so grace might be something that we consider to be a risk management strategy, or faith is a risk management strategy. But if you go by the biblical story of the Garden of Eden, risk was created there. Risk was created by a human decision that violated policy. Policy was, don't eat from the tree. Do any? That was operational risk. The policy was pretty clearly defined. Don't eat from the tree. Major consequences. Perhaps the consequences weren't well enough described. But if we take that story, we would say that all risk is of human origin, and it stuck with us. So, risk isn't going away. It's present at every business. Otherwise, what's the point? Why go into business if you're not going to take a risk? There is no excess return in theory and probably in practice. And sometimes in practice, even if you take a risk, there's not an excess return. But in theory, we shouldn't be getting anything extra if we're not going to take a risk. So why do something? It's rarely untouched. What I mean by that is risk happens because people do things. They make decisions. It happens throughout the process. And it's rarely touched by only a few. And this is where I'm going to get to the idea of multiple points of failure. The management of risk. Some people might think they're a bit biblical who manage risk because they've got a little bit of big heads on them, but I just put that in there because it was a way I could cut on some risk managers when we get a little big for our britches. It is of human origin. Everything that we do in risk management has been created by people. In the same way that encryption was created by people and passwords were created by people, every model we've built, every theory we've put forward, every action we take as a risk manager is done by a person. It is subject to failure. And risk management is mostly touched by only a few. There is no one-for-one correlation between risk managers and business decision makers. There are usually a few. In some cases, there are a large number of risk managers, but in no way is risk touched by many at most institutions. As I mentioned before, problems rarely begin in the tail. You might say that the Anderson debacle began in the tail. But I think that's a bit of a stretch because something happened between that person making the decision in one office to shred files and Anderson going away. Anderson's event is a tail event, and it's an enormous event, but I don't think it happened in the tail. I don't think it started in the tail. Can anyone name a company that's been wiped out by an overnight gap in the markets? Okay. One night? Any firms in terms of banks, insurance companies, broker dealers? Which one? Herstatt for the settlement risk. Okay, got two. Okay, it's a pretty rare event. So, out of all the companies in the world, all the financial service companies in the world, we can come up with two that may have gone out because of one night's event. You could argue whether that was something that took place in one day or something that was built up to. Here are most cited case studies that you'll typically see. All of them are companies that either went away or had enormous losses. None of these began in the tail. They all had some other origin that eventually built to a cataclysmic ending. Barings in particular, I think, is a great story on that. And LTCM, where there was obviously some understanding of risk, but something that went well beyond what their expectations were. Multiple points of failure is trying to create a system that fails well. If a market gaps overnight, I want a system that doesn't knock me out of business. If the markets move a substantial amount, or if someone is engaged in some fraudulent practice, I don't want that to knock me out of business. So what's my approach today? My approach today, maybe hold capital against those events, so that with some probability, I'm relatively assured to be around. A system that fails well is something that's called ductile. It's supposed to be the opposite of brittle. A brittle system breaks badly, a ductile system breaks well. If you can create a ductile system, maybe you can leverage more and get back to the same point of risk that you were taking originally, but since you have a system that you have a little bit more faith in, the system fails better and you can take more risk. This isn't the only thing that comes close to an equation in my presentation. It's just a ratio. But this is nothing new. Risks, returns over assumed risks, horribly simplified statement of what we talk about with risk-adjusted performance. But one thing I think we're not hearing enough talk about is that business lines, I could have shot myself with that. Business lines are responsible for returns, a little warm. But the business lines are also best placed to be responsible for assumed risk. Risk capital is often thought of as in the domain of the risk manager. It's the models that we put forward as risk managers that determine risk capital. But if the business lines are the ones responsible for the returns, why are we taking ownership away from them on the risk? They're creating it. To some extent, they're managing it. But why are we taking all of that away from them? Risk oversight, as I said, the cop role is still absolutely necessary. But now to think of your risk management role as not just someone who's delivering numbers, not just someone who's building models, but someone who's delivering education, a teacher. Many of you are in school now. You're taking things in from the people who are teaching you. A number of us who share resources through books, through presentations, are teaching. But how many of you go into your work each day and think of yourself as a teacher? If you're a risk manager and you take what you know and keep it to yourself, that's what the firm gets. It gets one person looking at whatever your area of responsibility is. You become a single point of failure. If you miss something, if your model's wrong, that's one system that can break badly. So I hope at least this is a new way of starting to think about what you do in your role as a risk manager. But mostly what I want to do is to start getting this mindset into the risk manager, and that's of empowering the business lines. Risk managers have advanced very quickly recently in seniority of their organizations. Chief risk officers, probably a term invented by James Lamb in, any guess, late 90s, 97, 98, something like that. Premia has something on the order of 100 CROs that belong to it right now. It is something that is being hired by many organizations because they all are convinced by their boards, by their shareholders, by events they've seen elsewhere that they need a chief risk officer. If that chief risk officer doesn't deliver something to them, we're going to see risk getting pushed back down. And risk won't be as important as we might make it. But if we're empowering the business lines by helping them to make the decisions, the risk manager who is now bringing value to the business line beyond what the cop could bring, absolutely beyond what the cop could bring, but beyond what a person delivering reports can bring, they're going to be invited into the process and will be in a permanent part of the business decision-making process. Okay, every quantitative presentation needs a fancy chart, but there's nothing that you can make out of that chart. It's just there because sometimes these are cool. The notion of this chart is that these are events that might occur, or let's just say an event that has some probability of happening. This event here costs the firm 1% of capital. This event down here costs the firm 100% of capital. along the bottom axis are when this event is stopped. So, is this event stopped at 5% of its potential, and its potential being 100% of capital? What's the probability of that happening? 50% of the potential, 90% of the potential. You'll see a very odd-looking drop-off there. My argument on this is if you're in 100% of capital, event that's going to cost you 100% of capital, and you've already reached 50% of the potential, the odds of being able to stop it are going to drop dramatically, because there's a bit of blood in the water at that point, and we know how kind the markets are when there's blood in the water. This has no basis in any kind of modeling. It's really a point of discussion. These are the numbers that go along with that graph that was there. Most events that are small or smallish, 1% of capital, 10% of capital is maybe not all that small, but when they start to reach their potential, the odds are it's going to be stopped at some point. I mean, we're getting up to near a near cataclysmic event, and systems are generally in place to catch stuff like this. And this is a big drop-off I talked about here with these large events. We focus in risk management on this area and out here, which is capitalizing to make sure we don't go out of business. This is the middle that I was talking about in terms of a focus. I'll leave the math to you to do. But if you, through your education, and if you, through your focus on teaching within your organizations, can change these probabilities, you've given the ability of the firm to leverage more. You've given the firm the ability to leverage more, because the likelihood of reaching a cataclysmic event that knocks you out of business is reduced, because you increase the frequency of events that occur partway out to the tail, and you reduce the frequency of events that actually reach the tail of the distribution. Risk managers can't be everywhere that risk is created, thus we're trying to focus on education and putting this notion out into the business lines, so that the business line people, who are the ones that are noticing events starting to emerge, are in this area, and they're the ones handling it. So, this is a slide I just threw together. It is not meant to suggest that this is the only career path for a risk manager, but it's a bit of a building block. The quantitative strength has to be there. Good risk managers all have strong quantitative skills. Applying and teaching the models that they build. First transition into being a teacher. First transition into education. Experience in a business line. If you don't know how a business works, if you don't know how a business makes money, it's hard to talk to them. So get some of that. This gets maybe a little bit out of your risk management world, or your safety zone. Moving into supervisory experience, P&L accountability, and more teaching. Risk management, business line leadership, and more teaching. Sharing what you know. This may seem a little far-fetched, but I was contacted about a job opening in New York where they're looking to hire a CRO, large asset manager. The CRO is being hired with the intent to groom them to be the CEO. That's new. That's a CRO moving into a business line decision-making role. And that's ultimately where risk management can go. So I would encourage everyone through this to become educators. You'll add value to your firm by being part of the planning process. You can add value to your firm by being part of these RARAC, RORAC, economic profit, risk capital allocation discussions. You can add value to your firm if you're a bank and you're moving towards Basel II. And if you add value, you get buy-in. Tom's point. I can have all the hurdle rates, I can have all the models, everything I need. If I can't get buy-in, it's of no use. More diversified knowledge of risk management. Multiple points of failure. And finally, enhanced firm value. And I would argue that combination of this education, as well as the type of modeling that Tom had talked about earlier, will significantly add value to firms. So Premia being founded has nothing to do with my talk, but part of my thinking about Premia, and part of the reason why I'm involved in Premia, is because I think this connection that we make between risk managers, this sharing of knowledge, this learning that we can create within our own business lines, is extremely important to the advancement of the risk management profession. And that's what Premia is trying to do. That's what I enjoy doing in this role. And again, I hope I haven't told you anything that you didn't know already, but I also hope that I've given you some way to come into work tomorrow and think about what you do a little bit differently And with that, I'll take questions about Premia or this, or what do we have? 5 minutes before the end of the evening.